Chapter 10. Return to the Source. There's a famous story from the early history of Zen in China. Master Joshu was having a discussion with a monk when a little puppy trotted up. The monk asked Joshu, "Does the dog have Buddha nature?" Now, Zen is a form of Mahayana Buddhism, and according to Mahayana philosophy, all beings have the Buddha nature. So the correct academic answer is simply yes, a dog has the Buddha nature. But in the original Chinese, the monk's question is stated in a very dualistic way, connoting something like, dog have Buddha nature, not have Buddha nature, which is it? Was the monk really asking a philosophical question about the Buddha nature? I think not. I suspect what he was really asking was, how can one transcend the duality of existence and non-existence? Or more broadly, how can one transcend all dualities, all conflicts, pleasure versus pain, inside versus outside, good versus evil, sense versus nonsense? So he put the question in a grammatical form that requires a dualistic response, requires taking sides. Which is it, yes or no? The sly monk is setting a trap for the master, doing the Zen equivalent of trolling. Is the master worth his mala? How will he handle the sly monk's trap? Joshu was familiar with the customs of Zen, so he no doubt immediately saw the question for what it was, a setup. Zen arose in China. In modern Chinese, the character for Zen is pronounced Chan. Chan is the hybrid child of Indian Mahayana Buddhism and Chinese culture. From Confucianism, it got its work ethic and its ritualized daily schedule. From Taoism, it inherited several things. A model for nature based on the dialectical interplay of yang and yin. A paradigm for enlightenment based on oneness, and the custom of dialoguing from a place of wisdom. The Taoists called that custom pure conversation. A pure conversation was an interaction in which people talked from the place of understanding the nature of nature. In the Taoist formulation, this meant to understand the interplay of yang and yin. In these pure conversations, they would speak from the wisdom mind. They would speak about the nature of nature from the nature of nature. Later, the Zen masters took over this Taoist tradition, and it turned into a distinctive style of dialogue called Mondo in Japanese. The puppy Mondo is one of the most famous. In the Rinzai Zen tradition, it's often the first koan, wisdom-generating conundrum, given to a student. Such a Zen dialogue is basically a contest, but it's really an anti-contest. It's a kind of reverse or paradoxical contest. It works like this. Two people talk, and the first one who speaks from the ego loses. The one who wants to win is certainly going to lose. That's why it's an anti-contest. The first one that fixates the self loses. Zen masters would have such dialogues as a playful thing. People who have seen the Buddha nature can play and talk from the Buddha nature. When the monk asked Joshu whether the dog had the Buddha nature, he was offering to play a game of spiritual tennis with the master. And the question was his opening serve, as it were. If you were the master in this situation, what would you do? You have to return the ball, which means that according to the rules of the game, you have to manifest the Buddha nature in your answer. If you fail to return the ball, then you've lost and the game is over. Remember that according to Mahayana Buddhism, all beings have the Buddha nature. Thus, the academic answer to the question is yes, the dog has the Buddha nature. Originally, the word Buddha nature referred to a potential. All beings have the potential to become liberated. But later it came to refer to the fact that at a deep and subtle level, all beings, just as they are, already function in a liberated way. In other words, precisely because we are already there, subliminally, we can get there, explicitly. So the monk is posing a rich and interesting challenge. Master Joshu, show me something regarding how our innate perfection allows for the transcendence of duality. And do so in a way that manifests that innate perfection. What the monk probably expected was that Joshu would manifest the Buddha nature as the dog nature in a playful manner, perhaps as an uninhibited bark. Woof, woof, woof. But Joshu didn't do that. He gave a very different answer. Instead of manifesting dog activity, he gave a seemingly incorrect and hence inscrutable response. He said, "No!" In my opinion, Joshu brilliantly fulfilled the challenge presented to him. My purpose in this chapter is to address a different challenge. My challenge will be to explain Joshu's answer in a conceptually clear way. I sometimes jokingly say that some Zen teachers don't say enough, and some mindfulness teachers say too much. Mea culpa. In Zen, initial enlightenment is called Kensho. Ken means to see, and Sho means nature. The nature that is seen is sometimes called Busho, Buddha nature, or Shinsho, the nature of consciousness, or Honrai no Memoku, your original face. Many people who work in the Rinzai tradition of Zen get their first taste of Kensho by working with Joshu's No. This koan is sometimes called Joshu's Mu. Mu is the Sino-Japanese word that I'm translating as No. It literally means not have or not exist. In modern Chinese, it's pronounced Wu. Which is the correct answer? Barking like a dog? Or No? I would suggest to you that both answers are correct. In order to pass the koan, you have to clearly understand why both answers are correct. You can't just play Zen. Anyone can intone moo. It's important to understand the relationship between woof, woof, woof and no. Each represents a way to transcend duality, and therefore represents a way to become free from suffering. Either answer is correct if you clearly understand why it addresses the question, and if you can manifest the answer confidently. Fully giving yourself to woof, woof, woof is one way to transcend duality. You completely affirm dog, so completely that you become the activity called dog. As we shall see, this is a yes that contains both yes and no, and hence is beyond yes or no. But how about Joshu's no? Well, that's a no that is neither yes nor no, and hence is also beyond yes or no. How can you come to the experience of the yes that contains both yes and no, and the no that's neither yes nor no? Lots of ways. In the Rinzai school of Zen, one typically does this through sustained equanimity, with a confused state induced by an unanswerable question. What is the sound of one hand? What is your original face? What is mu? Questions like these are called koans. Koans can be used for various purposes, but initially they're often used to stymie the conceptual mind. This induces a state of don't know. Learn to abide comfortably in that don't know long enough, and a new way of knowing will arise. That new way of knowing is called intuitive wisdom, prajna. That's one approach. But personally, I prefer to work within the framework of mindfulness. So is there a way to use mindfulness observing techniques to achieve the same goal? Sure. In fact, I already described half of it in the previous chapter when I explained how to note gone. Joshu's mu is simply gone experienced with great clarity. The no that is neither yes nor no, that transcends all duality, is present in each ordinary vanishing, although it may take a while to fully appreciate that fact. Not known, because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. T.S. Eliot, Little Gidding. But how about the other half of the picture? The gush and gather of space, the sheer love that molds the activity called dog, that molds the activity called self, that molds the activity called world. For that, pay close attention to the very instant when things arise. Just note, start. As soon as any inner or outer sensory event begins to arise, there's a spreading of activation. But right behind that activation, keeping perfect pace with it, there's a sequence of little gons that sum together into the perception of space effortlessly collapsing. It's like you're dragging an eraser behind you all day long. I once heard a Zen master say that a good doctor can cure your disease, but only a great doctor can show you that you were never sick. Paradoxically, the effortless, great perfection of things can sometimes show itself on occasions where you would least expect it, occasions when you find yourself in big trouble. There are two common expressions that we use to describe the experience of overwhelm. One is, I'm being flooded. Too much is happening in too many places at once. Mental images, mental talk, physical and emotional sensations, and perhaps also sights and sounds, pulling you in all directions at once. The other expression is, the rug is being pulled out from under me, meaning that your center has been ripped away, You've been decentered. But look carefully. Decentering creates a sequence of micro-gons. The space of self collapses moment by moment. Metaphorically, we feel small, helpless, vulnerable. But it's not just that we feel small. We are literally shrinking, being contracted out of existence. Look carefully, really carefully. We're not helpless. Very much the opposite. That decentering, that shrinking of selfhood, can become something pleasant, like being gently squeezed. The flooding is your consciousness being stretched out into space in many directions at once. It's expansion, affirmation, yes, but each spreading engenders a collapse within. It's contraction, negation, no. Nature is constantly pointing us to freedom. The primordial perfection is always there. We just need to look at things in a different way. Bring concentration, clarity, and equanimity to your experience. Do that consistently for a long time. At some point, you will hopefully notice an ordering principle that's so primordial that it can never be disordered. No matter how uncomfortable your body might get, no matter how confused or negative your mind might become, that discomfort, confusion, or negativity is always surrounded by an effortless spontaneity. Once you notice this, you realize that you never needed to train, never needed to search, never needed to improve. But, and there's just no way around this one, it may require considerable training before you're able to notice this, and noticing it should give you an optimal place from which to improve yourself. In terms of time, there's an absolute tranquility that precedes and follows each thing we see, hear, or feel, and each thing we do, say, or think. In terms of space, there's an effortless spread and collapse that expands around and contracts within each thing we see, hear, or feel, and each thing we do, say, or think. Indeed, each sensory or motor event is really just a cloud of effervescent foam churned up in the cleft that arises between this inward and outward motion. Think of Hokusai's print, The Great Wave off Kanagawa. Each moment of life is born from the shearing forces that arise between those oppositely directed doings. Each moment is molded by sheer love, molded by the shear of love. Absolute tranquility polarizes into simultaneous expansion-contraction, which briefly molds a moment of time, space, self, and world. When that expansion and contraction cancel into gone, they carry with them all the richness of that sensory moment, leading to an even richer state of absolute tranquility. One might be tempted to equate arising with expansion and passing with contraction. And indeed, from a superficial point of view, that's quite reasonable. But the unfixated standpoint of Zen asks for a deeper formulation. As soon as something begins to arise, it's already beginning to pass. In my beginning is my end, as T.S. Eliot put it, riffing on Mary, Queen of Scots motto. Realizing that arising entails simultaneous expansion and contraction is the deeper view that allows us to stay on the razor's edge of absolute now, to ride the Zen ox backward to the absolute rest of gone. Gone occurs when expansion and contraction simultaneously cease, mutually cancel. Gone is the no that is neither yes nor no, neither good nor bad, neither sense nor nonsense. But gone is not a thing. It's what happens when all the yeses or noes needed to mold this world simultaneously cancel out. So it's incredibly rich, perhaps endlessly rich. The medieval Christian mystics called it nihil per excellentium, nothing par excellence. What's the difference between the nihil of the mystic, the successful practitioner, and the nihil of the nihilist, the cynical curmudgeon? They're both forms of nothing, yet their human significance couldn't be more different. The difference is in the path taken to get there. The nihilist has been wounded by the world over and over again, and as a result, has come to an emptiness that's bleak and paralyzing. The mystic has seen the world arise from nothing over and over again. But equally important, the mystic has seen nothing digest the world over and over again. For the mystic, the richness of the world is contained in that nothing. Gone is not only a source of tranquility and safety, it's a source of fulfillment, empowerment, and love. To borrow a metaphor from thermodynamics, the human significance of nothingness is a path-dependent variable. Because expansion and contraction pervade everything we sense and do, it seems reasonable to think of them as our nature. But how about a dog's nature? Observe a dog, or any other animal for that matter. It's obvious that everything the dog senses or does has an exuberant, just-happening quality. That's why we enjoy having pets. So clearly, the dog has the Buddha nature. What about a plant or a rock? Do they have the Buddha nature? Is the Buddha nature, as described above, in fact, the nature of everything, the nature of nature? Almost all the mystic masters of the past have claimed that the experiences they have in contemplation reveal directly the nature of the real world. But are such claims justified? The 20th century British philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote the classic essay, Mysticism and Logic. In Russell's view, such all-encompassing claims based on mystical experience are philosophically unjustified. The mystic may learn things about the nature of experience that are useful, important, and not known by most people. But the nature of objective reality is the purview of science and science only. In general, I tend to agree with Russell. On the other hand, nature as described by mystics and nature as investigated by scientists have some sort of relationship. I don't think it's possible at this point in the history of our species to state with confidence what that relationship is. Indeed, arriving at a consensus regarding this issue is the central quest of the science of enlightenment. But if I had to shoot from the hip and make a wild-ass guess, it would be that the great primordial perfection discovered by the mystics is what happens when the human nervous system directly tastes the free energy principle that underlies its functioning, delta G. But that's just a conjecture. What I can say with confidence is this primordial great perfection is not just a piece of esoterica. It's something useful for you to know about. The window could open for you at any time, perhaps when you least expect it or most need it. The Tibetans have an exclamatory cry reserved just for when that window opens. The cry is, Emaho, which might be loosely rendered, Oh my God, who would have thought it's this simple? Is the Buddha nature as described above also the nature of everything, the nature of nature? I don't have a clue. But it can be fun to speculate, as long as we don't take ourselves too seriously. For starters, if indeed the primordial great perfection has something to do with the nervous system tasting free energy, and hence entropy, then the answer would be yes, because free energy and entropy are important variables in many areas of physical science. Thus, the Buddha nature could turn out to be thermodynamics, as experienced directly by the neurons themselves, as opposed to indirectly through physical reasoning and mathematical equations. Just a thought, not to be taken seriously at this point. Another perspective might be to think of nature in dialectical terms. The Buddha nature as described above entails a binary contrast, expansion versus contraction. The sensory experience of inner self, mental image, mental talk, and body emotion, and the sensory experience of outer scene, sight, sound, and physical body sensation, are born in between those forces. Furthermore, those forces can cancel into a rich nothing. Do themes like binary contrast, born in-betweenness, and mutual cancellation reveal the nature of nature? Once again, I don't have a clue, but I do find the idea aesthetically pleasing. Recall that Zen inherited a dialectical philosophy from Chinese culture. Yang is expansion, Yin is contraction. When they act together, it's called Taiji, the great Tai polarization, Ji. When they mutually cancel, it's called Wuji, the absence, Wu, of polarity, Ji. These notions underlie Asian martial arts and medical practices. But it's not just an Eastern thing. Western philosophers, from Heraclitus to Hegel, have been fascinated by the notion of dialectical interplay. Couples are things whole and not whole. What is drawn together and what is drawn asunder, the harmonious and discordant. The one is made up of all things, and all things issue from the one. Heraclitus. The dialectic interplay is even found in Christianity. For example, in the writings of the scholastic philosopher Nicholas of Cusa, who spoke of God as coincidentia oppositorum, the falling together of opposites. But perhaps most important of all, binary contrast, born in betweenness, and mutual cancellation are fundamental to the mathematics we most commonly use to model the natural world, the complex numbers system. The complex numbers are an intricate interweaving involving three flavors of binary contrasts, each with its own neutral canceled state. The first contrast is step forward versus step back, complex addition. The second contrast is stretch out versus pull in, the dilation aspect of complex multiplication. The third contrast is turn right versus turn left, the rotational aspect of complex multiplication. The vast majority of functions that scientists use to describe the physical world arise from the interplay of those contrasts. So they are, in a sense, born in between those contrasts. For another example, consider the genetic code. Tear the DNA apart, and it basically contains a sequence of yeses and nos in a certain order. DNA contains a code of yeses and nos that, when expressed in a body, can genetically program a dog. Your computer operates by storing yeses and nos as high and low voltages. The physicist John Wheeler famously conjectured it, the cosmos, from bit, binary information. The no that is beyond yes and no is what happens when all the yeses and all the nos line up and cancel out. A dog, or any other particular activity of consciousness, is what happens when the yeses and nos polarize, when they push and pull to mold a dog into existence. Pushing out to create a nose, pulling in to open the nostrils, pushing out to create ears, pulling in to make a mouth, stretching down and back to form legs and a tail, puffing out plumply to manifest a belly, and so on. This is the activity called perceiving a dog.
When this interplay of opposites comes to an end, when the wave reaches completeness, it flatlines into a moment of absolute nothing. This could be called zero, or the unborn. If you wanted to use the vocabulary of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, it would be called Nirodha, or cessation.
This is how the Yoga Sutras begin. Yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of consciousness. Then and only then does the true observer abide in its true nature. This cessation of consciousness is called emptiness, shunyata, or zero in Buddhism. But the best way to come to that cessation is to fully participate in each ordinary experience by quickly and loudly saying yes at the instant of its arising. For example, when you look at a flower, or hear a bell, or play with a dog, you so fully give your awareness to it that there is no time to fixate that awareness into a thing. When awareness is unfixated, you don't have nouns like flower, bell, or dog. You have the activity called flower, or the activity called bell, or the activity called dog. And that activity completes itself. Watch where it goes. All the contrasts gather together and cancel out, and there is time out of time. Zero. Gone. A momentary cessation of the fluctuations of consciousness. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point. There would be no dance, and there is only the dance. T.S. Eliot, Burnt Norton.
However, that cessation doesn't last. It's inherently unstable because it's made out of yes and no, expansion and contraction, yang and yin. At any instant, it can spontaneously repolarize. If you're paying attention to your experiences, you'll begin to notice how experiences are molded by affirmation and negation, by pushing out and pulling in, by expansion and contraction. Give yourself to that pushing out and pulling in, totally and utterly, until you become that pushing out and pulling in. Don't be afraid to let it tear you apart. Don't worry. It may kill you as a noun, but it will give you life as a verb. You become the doing of you, the activity called you. When you are just the activity of you, everything you got from Father God, you graciously return to Father God. Everything you got from Mother God, you graciously return to Mother God. Now there is nothing in between to prevent the two halves of God from reuniting. The meditator disappears. The true observer, who doesn't exist inside time and space, appears. But the true observer doesn't need to observe or be observed. It's the ultimate simplicity, a kind of dimensionless, unfixated point that is the groundless ground. It's not any particular place, because it gives rise to each particular place. The place of the dog, the place of the tree, the place of your room, the place of this book, and so on. The two sides of this activity are the two right answers to the koan, does the dog have the Buddha nature? To answer it, you have to be in contact with both sides of the Buddha nature, the side that polarizes and manifests the activity of dog, and the side that neutralizes and manifests zero. The former is the yes that involves both yes and no. The latter is the no that is neither yes nor no. Impermanence. I know both from my own practice and from teaching others that this model of Buddha nature fits well with the facts of experience and can bring you to an earth-shaking sense of freedom and fulfillment. It is a kind of theory of everything, if we take everything to mean every experience that a human being can have. Although this philosophy that sees the activity of the source in terms of a pair of complementary doings is found all over the world, describing impermanence in terms of the two principles of expansion and contraction was not the way the Buddha himself taught. When you look carefully, however, you can see that it is implicitly there. Rather than expansion and contraction, early Buddhism uses the expression udaya, arising, and vyaya, passing. And usually in the Vipassana tradition, that's how you get insight into impermanence. You watch things arise and pass, arise and pass. Since the terms arising and passing already exist in Theravada Buddhism, you may wonder why I bother with expansion and contraction. The reason is that the terms expansion and contraction give us a broader, more general paradigm to work with, because we can think of them as fundamental forces or qualities. This can be very helpful when we meditate on seemingly stable phenomena, things that don't seem to be arising or passing. For example, when a sensation seems rock solid, no matter how carefully we investigate it, doesn't seem to change at all, we might think that there is no impermanence there. There is absolutely no change whatsoever. There's no arising or passing. It's sitting still. But the expansion-contraction model allows us to analyze it in a different way. Basically, there are two kinds of tensions or solidity that one encounters in meditation practice. Tensions that we can intentionally relax, and tensions that we cannot intentionally relax. For the former, I recommend relaxing them, and if need be, continually re-relaxing them. The reason for my recommendation is that sustaining global relaxation represents a simple and tangible way to create equanimity. But what about the other kinds of tensions, those that we cannot intentionally relax? They can be quite uncomfortable, but they do have a silver lining, so to speak. They represent, in an observable way, deeply held limiting forces within us. The trick is to welcome unrelaxable tensions with as much equanimity as possible. That will allow for optimal purification. The expansion and contraction paradigm can help here. If a phenomenon is solid, unchanging, and uncomfortable, that's because there are pressure forces involved. Either there is a pressure force trying to push out, or a pressure force trying to pull in, or there is both a force moving out and a force moving in at exactly the same time. Even though the phenomenon doesn't change, you may still be able to detect the underlying polarized pressure forces of expansion and contraction within it. In solidity, the two oppositely directed pressure forces bang against each other, causing coagulation and suffering. What to do? Bring equanimity to it. But how? Think of equanimity as giving the expansion permission to expand, and giving the contraction permission to contract, even though that may temporarily make the discomfort worse. Expansion and contraction crash against each other over and over, but if you give each of them permission to do its thing, at some point they sort of interdigitate. That is, they pass through each other. Painful pressure turns into blissful gush and gather. When things solidify, when there's pressure in body, mind, sight, or sound, people have a tendency to blame themselves. I'm resisting. I can't let go. Expansion and contraction give us a different way to think about pressure and solidity. It doesn't have to be about you at all. It's about two impersonal forces eventually learning how to mutually interpenetrate without mutually interfering. Relating to unrelaxable solidity in this way can help you to develop equanimity. This paradigm allows you to contact impermanence, even with phenomena that seem to be permanent. Things that don't move still show us a Nietzsche in disguise. If we look very carefully, we will see that the two elements of impermanence, expansion and contraction, are there. But they are there as forces rather than as movements. So working with solidity is a practical application of the expansion-contraction paradigm. Far more important, however, is how this paradigm helps us avoid a classic potential pitfall in mindfulness practice, the observer trap. When we talk about observing arising and passing, it could imply that there is a separate observer who is watching the arising and passing. You, the fixated observer, sit over here, watching the arising and passing occurring over there. This sense of being an observer is good at first, because initially, you need a meditating self to implement a technique. But in the end, it is a trap, because if the observer gets fixated, it becomes a kind of ego identity. The arising and passing is, in a sense, flat and objectified. Expansion, contraction, on the other hand, is round and encompassing. It rips away your center of gravity, breaking down the sense of an observer fixated in some specific place. Expansion, the father, spreads out to the right, to the left, front and back, above and below. Wherever we might try to fixate our sense of self, it is going to be yanked away from us. Contraction, the mother, pulls in from the right, from the left, front and back, above and below, but not to any specific point. This unfixated center of gravity becomes a new ordering principle that holds us safe in a motherly embrace. Our usual sense of order involves fixating some point as the center of our being and establishing a boundary to form the border of our being. But because expansion and contraction are all pervasive, they won't let us fixate a center or maintain a border. We have to completely let go and get pulled into that flow. Then we become that flow. We become father and mother. From sensation to source. Now let's look at how to use this concept in actual meditation practice. Really experiencing it for yourself is the only way to pass the koan, to understand Joshu's no. Let's say that you're meditating, and you become aware that you have a pain in your leg. You pay close attention to this pain, get a very clear sense of its shape, watch how its intensity may vary, let your awareness sort of float and circulate within it. At some point, you notice that sensation begins to soften a little, and becomes more like a jellyfish, sort of puffing out here and pulling in there, like a two-dimensional surface that is waving in and out. Then as you penetrate more deeply into that, you realize that each time something puffs up or wells up, inside that welling up are small vibrations. The welling up is nothing but a whole bunch of tiny vibrations. Then those vibrations die down, that whole region of the sensation subsides, and this brings an insight. You get a very clear perception that two scales of impermanence are happening simultaneously. A stately undulatory movement, and within each undulation, a more rapid vibratory movement. As you pay even closer attention, you start to notice something that is quite subtle. When the upwelling takes place, there are actually two oppositely directed movements, one pushing out and one pulling in, and they arise at exactly the same time and with more or less equal strength, simultaneous and equal expansion and contraction. As these oppositely directed forces move, one at the core of the arising pulling in and one at the perimeter pushing out, they produce vibrations in between them. The vibrations come about because of the polarization of these two forces. You can experience this quite tangibly in something as ordinary as your smile. If you really pay attention to what it feels like when you smile, you can feel the muscles contracting, while at the same time, the quality of pleasure around the smile is expanding and spreading. You can feel a contractive core in the smile and an expansive perimeter simultaneously. You can also detect this concurrent expansion-contraction in your breath. When you breathe in, the chest expands, but at the same time, the intercostal muscles are contracting. You can feel the expansion of your chest in terms of its volume, while all around there is a contraction of the muscles. When you breathe out, the chest collapses or contracts in volume, but you can feel it as expanding in the sense that all the muscles relax and stretch. You can actually feel those polarizations of expansion and contraction going on in everyday experiences like the breath and your smile. It's not something esoteric or remote. It's everywhere and in everything. You can observe it in your thinking, too. When your mind is scattered, you sense your thoughts going in many directions at once. That scattering is expansive. At the same time, you feel an urge to somehow gather them together, to find the central point of those thoughts. This urge to get to the point is contractive. So thought is born in between the gushing and gathering of space. Zen people say that the ordinary mind is the way. The ordinary mind is the Tao. What is the ordinary mind? The ordinary mind is constantly scattered in many directions and cannot hold a center. We think this monkey mind experience is awful. People feel tormented by the ceaseless turning of the mind. But when you look beneath surface appearances, the scattering can be interpreted as space effortlessly spreading, and the inability to hold a center could be looked upon as contraction gobbling up the solid ground beneath you. We are so preoccupied with determining the specific meaning of thought that we suffer because we can't look at it in terms of its universal movement. Because we somehow feel we have to extract meaning from this motion, we suffer. But if we are willing to just let the mind scatter and pull in at the same time, letting go of any need to make meaning, we reframe the situation. It's just another spontaneous space fountain gushing and gathering. This puts us in contact with the universal meaning that underlies the meaning of every thought. It's the meaning of a flower, the meaning of a galaxy. If you stay with that experience, you will notice that at some point, the part that was pushing out isn't pushing out anymore, and the part that was pulling in isn't pulling in anymore. It's as if they commingle, the positive and the negative, the plus and the minus, the expansive and contractive, and mutually cancel. And that is when all the waves and little wavelets die away. They flatline. And in that cancellation is an experience of absolute rest, Nirodha, a moment of nirvana, the peace of God's own heaven. Then suddenly you become aware that the forces are pulling apart again. Expansion is pulling out, contraction is pulling in. Once again, vibration is born in between the two. This vibration came from the flatline breaking up. The canceled state of the universe has again polarized into a contrast of expansion and contraction, and absolute rest disappeared for a moment. It broke up its two halves, plus and minus, efflux and reflux. Continue to observe. Once again, the half that is pushing out stops pushing out, and the half that is pulling in stops pulling in. The two come together, and there is another moment of earth-shattering tranquility. What in the Christian tradition is called the peace that passeth understanding. And you come to realize that every experience is just another cycle of bliss. Even the sense of a material body experiencing pain goes away, and it is replaced by this rhythm of polarizing, vibrating, neutralizing peace, polarizing, vibrating, neutralizing peace, over and over again. It's effortless effervescence, alternating with earth-shaking peace. That's what the pain really was all along. This leads to a major shift in your understanding. Eventually, you switch from identifying with the content of experience to identifying with the contour of experience. When you start to meditate, it seems like your mind and body are the abiding background, and within them, you are having various sensory experiences. But at some point, a striking figure-ground reversal takes place. Your mind and body become a transient figure, and the field of impermanence becomes the abiding ground. For a moment, you shift from identifying with the mind and body, which are the product of that field, to identifying with the field itself. For a period of time, you unbecome the product of impermanence, and you re-identify with impermanence itself. Impermanence viewed this way could also be called spirit. Or even soul. That is a profound change in your fundamental perspective of things. It seems as if you're participating in the activity of the source. You become the source. You realize that you are the source. You realize that you are not your mind and body. You are the source of your mind and body, which is also the source of all minds and all bodies. You probably began meditation practice by learning to hold one thing, the in and out breath of your body, for example. Hopefully, at some point, you will experience being held by the source of all things, the in and out breath of the universe. When you have a complete thought, meaning that you pay close attention from beginning to end, allowing the thought to demonstrate its flow qualities, that thought contains all the meanings in the universe. That may sound extreme, but since everything comes about through a polarization of expansion and contraction, any particular thing that you experience in these terms is linked to all things. The expansion and contraction in your thought is no different than the expansion and contraction that makes atoms vibrate, that makes stars pulsate. There are two forces that drive a star: the force of self-gravity that pulls the star inward, and the force of thermal pressure pushing outward. In between those two forces, the star lives its life, fusing new atomic elements into existence with each cycle of expansion and contraction. As long as stars expand and contract, then you also will be expanding and contracting, because you too are this fundamental movement of the universe. The whole universe, your inner and outer sensory experience, comes from the source and returns to the source, moment by moment. Although your mind and body will someday pass away, once you have had this experience of returning to the source, you'll identify somewhat less with that mind and body. Even though you are just a separate individual who has certain thoughts and feelings, certain goals, certain bad habits, and certain desires, you realize that you are also none other than the activity of the entire universe. As long as the fundamental forces of the universe act, as long as there is affirmation and negation, as long as anything breathes, as long as zero polarizes and neutralizes, as long as matter and antimatter come out of nothing and return to nothing, the real you continues to live. Zero. The ancient Taoists had the right idea with yang and yin, but they were missing a major piece, because ancient Chinese civilization didn't have the concept of the number zero. That was introduced later from India. The only way Joshu could express the cancellation of positive and negative, the mutual annihilation of yes and no, was to say no. But with modern mathematics, we can call it zero instead. Just as expansion and contraction have many other names, such as plus minus and yang yin, gone can also be called by other names: the unborn, the witness, the true self, no self, emptiness, the peace of heaven. Some of these seem to contradict each other, but they are all referring to the same experience, the rich and fulfilling nothingness from which each something arises and to which it returns. Standard Buddhism calls it emptiness, but another possible name is zero. In English, the two terms are more related than they appear to be. In Sanskrit, the mathematical number zero is called shunya, and in Mahayana philosophy, the word translated as emptiness is shunyata, literally zero-ness. People are often put off by the Buddhist philosophy of emptiness, but emptiness is not empty. It's rich and springy. It contains the entire universe, collapsed into a canceled state, zero. Because zero is made up of everything, it has the possibility to create anything. You can arrive at zero in a lot of different ways, which in turn give different experiences. The experience of nothing is path-dependent, so to speak. The path you take to zero can either be bleak and a bummer, or rich and vibrant. You can have an experience of emptiness just by ignoring things, but that is not a very rich experience. On the other hand, if you get to emptiness by the path of simplification, you understand why many mystics have chosen to describe God as a special kind of nothing. Mindfulness is the path of simplification. In mindfulness, the complexity of sensory experience is reduced through progressively deeper unifications. No matter how big, complex, or overwhelming experiences may be, in mindfulness, we learn to break them down into the simplicity of the six senses, inner and outer, visual, auditory, and somatic experience. In other words, by analyzing experience into its sensory components, we can reduce the 10 trillion somethings of the world to combinations and subdivisions of just 6 sensory elements. But that is by no means the ultimate simplification. Next, you further simplify the senses by experiencing them in terms of impermanence, or flow. That is much simpler than 6 senses. But impermanence itself has many different guises or flavors: undulation, vibration, pixelation, scintillation, spiking, collapsing. Eventually, however, you realize that the various flavors of impermanence all arise from the interplay of just 2 flavors, expansion and contraction. So you've reduced everything down to just those 2. But things can become even further simplified. Sometimes you are primarily aware of expanding. Sometimes you are primarily aware of contracting. Sometimes you're aware that both are present at the same time. But if you look very carefully, you'll realize that any arising entails both. And at the point of vanishing, those 2 doings merge into the one nothing, which is the simplest state of all. 0, the source, Joshu's no. Then the cycle continues. The one nothing breaks into the 2 doings, and the 2 doings give birth to the 10 trillion somethings. But then you realize that no matter what sorts of things arise between the 2 hands of God, they are always directly touched by those 2 hands. The 2 doings are a kind of umbilical cord that connect the 10 trillion somethings of the world with the one nothing that is the source of the world. For a liberated person, that umbilical cord is never totally severed. This is true non-dual awareness. It's not just the oneness of inside and outside. It's the oneness of form and formless, the direct contact of creation with Creator. To experience this throughout the day is to achieve what some Christians call the practice of the presence of God, and what the Jewish tradition calls Shiviti Hashem Ngedi Tamid, which might loosely be rendered as be face to face with God all day. But there is a further subtlety about 0. In point of fact, you never actually experience 0. You never experience emptiness. You never experience the cancellation of expansion and contraction. That would seem to contradict everything I just wrote. But this is where the subtlety lies. In the actual moment of cancellation, there is no self to know the source. Thus, there is no experience there. It is nirodha, extinction. There's nobody there to have an experience. However, in the very next instant, the self returns and looks back at the moment of gone that just happened. It creates an image of that moment, and words to describe that moment, and it feels fulfillment, safety, peace, and love as the result of that moment. But that image and those words and those feelings are not 0 itself. They are a sort of after representation of 0. In fact, enlightenment is simply the ability to formulate a clear sensory representation of the formless state that immediately precedes each experience of form. Thus, enlightened wisdom is a kind of illusion, in the sense that it's composed of thought and feeling. It's just another conditioned event, not the unconditioned state itself. However, it's different from other conditioned events in that it represents something that is unconditioned. As your enlightenment deepens, you become clearer and clearer about what happens just before time, space, self, and world arise, and you come to a clearer and clearer realization that you are what happens just before time, space, self, and world arise. It's important not to identify with wisdom mind. The actual moment of gone is not experienced by anyone. What you experience is afterglow. You never directly experience God. You only experience the afterglow of God. That may sound like a letdown, but it's not, not at all. Each day is peppered with a holy glow. More about dissolution. In meditation practice, we learn to follow the senses back to where they come from, which reveals where we ourselves come from. With commitment to practice and the guidance of competent instructors, most people can eventually have that experience. It's a good process, but it's not necessarily always a pleasant process. Sometimes it can be somewhat destabilizing. Depending upon various factors, such as psychological disposition, early conditioning, genetics, random chance, some people experience significant instability along the journey from surface to source. For example, things might become quite chaotic, and it seems like you are literally being torn apart, like you're being ground up, like you're exploding and being crushed at the same time. Not everyone goes through this sense of utter chaos, but quite a few people do have to experience at least a little disorientation and fear before they get to primordial order. We call this process bhanga, the Sanskrit word for dissolution. If it should happen that everything seems to be falling apart, that it seems like you're being torn apart, well, in fact, you are. Your parents are tearing you apart. It sounds ghastly, I know, not a very politically correct way of talking. As offensive and inscrutable as this language is, when you find yourself being blown away and crushed, flooded and decentered, it can be helpful to know that these forces are in fact your parents in disguise. It is God, not the devil, that is tearing you apart. You can trust it. There are two sides to bhanga, the pleasant side and the unpleasant side. The pleasant side feels like blissful bubbles and vibrations all over you. It's somewhat like a runner's high, but more intense and pleasurable. After you're done exercising, you can have a runner's high that feels like your whole body is shimmering. If you have concentration power and great somatic resolution, and you tune into this experience, you'll see that runner's high is actually a sort of subtle bubbly flow, which is your body showing you its impermanent nature. Most people experience runner's high as a general state of euphoria. That's because they don't have the capacity to observe somatic sensations at high resolution. But if you really tune in, you can see that it's impermanence in the form of shimmering vibratory flow. Some people pass through a stage in meditation where that vibratory flow utterly inundates not only their body, but also their mind. And then it spreads out into external sight and sound, and everything turns into this scintillating, bubbly field of energy. When it's like this, dissolution is a very blissful experience. On the other hand, dissolution can be a very harsh and jarring experience, in which it seems like your mind can't make sense of anything. Your intellect is being torn from you. Your center of gravity is being ripped away. Your borders are being violated. There's no way you can be comfortable in the mind or the body. There are only two ways you can get any comfort at all. One is equanimity, meaning a kind of acceptance of the situation. The other is by contacting the underlying forces that are tearing you apart. You are being blown away and crushed. Blown away means expansion. Crushed means contraction. If you know what to look for and are able to give yourself simultaneously to father and mother, surrender to the forces of ripping and pounding. Those forces eventually evolve into a delicious, gentle stretching and squeezing. If it seems like you are dropping into scary states of chaos as you are meditating, understand that that's a stage some people have to go through. Take equanimity and impermanence as your refuge and try to get with the program. Understand that your ordinary, ordering principle is being ripped away. The body cannot get comfortable. The mind cannot get answers. But a new ordering principle, which is much deeper, is in the process of revealing itself. To repeat, not everybody goes through dramatic bhanga experiences. Some people do this path with blissful dissolutions. For some people, this path is composed of a mixture of blissful and not-so-blissful dissolution. Many people never go through a bhanga stage. They just drop into freedom. In 1948, the Anglo-American T.S. Eliot was awarded a Nobel Prize in Literature for his contribution to modern-day poetry, including a relatively short poetic work entitled Four Quartets. Although it covers a range of topics, the main theme is what I refer to as the awkward intermediate zone. The awkward intermediate zone is a stage that some meditators pass through wherein the old coping mechanism, tighten up and turn away, is in the process of being shed, but the new coping mechanism, open up and turn toward, is not yet strong enough to provide abiding safety and fulfillment. Here's a poetic description of that from Eliot's Little Gidding. Midwinter spring is its own season, sempiternal, though sodden towards sundown, suspended in time between pole and tropic. When the short day is brightest with frost and fire, the brief sun flames the ice on pond and ditches, in windless cold that is the heart's heat, reflecting in a watery mirror a glare that is blindness in the early afternoon. And glow more intense than blaze of branch or brazier stirs the dumb spirit, no wind but Pentecostal fire in the dark time of the year. Between melting and freezing, the soul's sap quivers. Where is the summer, the unimaginable zero summer? Between melting and freezing, the soul's sap quivers, nicely describes the alternating cycle of solidification and flow that some people go through in the intermediate stages of their practice. When that happens, the student is encouraged to greet both the rocky tension and the luscious bliss with the same response, equanimity. This optimizes progress. Although influenced by Buddhism and Hinduism, Eliot's primary allegiance was to Christianity. In the Four Quartets, Eliot describes dissolution by way of poignant Christian symbolism. He compares it to being in a hospital staffed by the Holy Trinity. The three persons operate on the patient's soul, excising the sin, removing the blocks to beatitude. Eliot's view of Christianity was essentially medieval, a view I share. The mystic is anyone who is willing to experience purgatory in this life. The reward is a direct and abiding glimpse of heaven in this life. Here's how he describes God's hospital. The wounded surgeon plies the steel that questions the distempered part. Beneath the bleeding hands we feel the sharp compassion of the healer's art, resolving the enigma of the fever chart. Our only health is the disease, if we obey the dying nurse, whose constant care is not to please, but to remind of our and Adam's curse, and that to be restored, our sickness must grow worse. The whole earth is our hospital, endowed by the ruined millionaire, wherein if we do well, we shall die of the absolute paternal care that will not leave us, but prevents us everywhere. The chill ascends from feet to knees. The fever sings in mental wires. If to be warmed, then I must freeze and quake in frigid purgatorial fires, of which the flame is roses and the smoke is briars. Flame is roses and the smoke is briars nicely summarizes the mix of agony and ecstasy that some practitioners experience during the dissolution process. The source of us all. Does the dog have the Buddha nature? What is your answer to this koan? The answer is to participate in the activity of your source. But your source is also everyone's source. To the extent that you contact your source, you contact everybody's source, the formless womb which expands and contracts, loving self and other into and out of being. What do we call someone with whom we share a womb? We call them a sibling. In Greek, the word for sibling is adelphos, which means literally from the same womb. We've all been birthed into existence by the same formless womb, and therefore we are all siblings. When you allow yourself to be pulled back to the source, to drop to the groundless ground, your happiness is no longer dependent on the vagaries of conditions. But returning to the source is not just for that. It's not only something we do for ourselves. When you realize your source, you have no choice but to see everyone as a close relative. Each time you interact with another person, you experience both yourself and that person being loved into existence by the source. It's not a belief or an emotion, but a direct sensory experience that's always there. So it's easy and natural to care for others. In the end, Master Joshu's no calls us to a life of spontaneous service.